Good morning.
Good morning.
Today we start off with a nice lightweight topic, sexual abuse. Not what I would normally kickstart my morning off with. There's a stack coming around.
Oh, well, there they are.
Any questions, comments, whatever, before I get rolling today? I don't have any announcements above and beyond that I made yesterday. Sexual abuse is a big problem. How big? Well, the answer you get depends on what you count as sexual abuse and what you don't, to some extent. You know, there certainly are things that everybody agrees is sexual abuse, rape, molesting a kid, etc. But our culture is going through some transitions, and what counts as abuse and what doesn't, there isn't always a consensus about. When I was a kid growing up, guys were taught that their role was to push as far as they could on a date, and if they got slapped, they should stop. That's no longer the norm. But for example, if you text a nude photo of yourself to somebody, is that sexual abuse? Or is it bad judgment, or is it flirting? Well, it depends on the context and the relationship and whether the other party is interested in receiving this text or not. And so when you look at the research trying to figure out numbers on sexual abuse, it's not easy to sort out because different people use different criteria for deciding what counts as sexual abuse and what doesn't. So sort of rough estimates using reasonable criteria, not being extremely broad or extremely narrow, somewhere around 20 to 25% of American women report having experienced sexual abuse during childhood. A third of the time, the perpetrator is the father. About 40% of American women who are in therapy report sexual abuse at some point in their life. And in one study, three-quarters of a sample of borderline clients reported a history of sexual abuse. That's a higher percentage than I hear of from my borderline clients, and it's just one study, so I wonder if that sample was skewed in some way. But certainly, borderline clients often report a history of sexual abuse. In some studies, a majority of American college students report having experienced some form of sexual aggression or victimization after the age of 14. So we're talking about a very common experience, deciding on where you, depending on where you draw the line. And all of these figures are from before the Me Too movement. So heaven knows if you get the same numbers these days or not. But whatever the actual numbers are, it's clear that this is a widespread problem. And it's not just, history. This is something that has impact. Now, there's also a lot of debate as to just what impact it has. Certainly, it's upsetting in the moment. It's upsetting in the short run. And some people approach sexual abuse as though it's always enormously traumatizing for everybody all the time. And others treat it as reasonably ordinary. A high proportion of women experience, and also no shortage of guys, report a history of sexual abuse. Again, trying to look at things reasonably and use reasonable criteria, the research shows an increased rate of chronic depression, of suicidality, of sexual, of self-destructive behavior, of interpersonal and sexual difficulties, of chronic anxiety, of PTSD. But one thing to notice is that these are also problems that are not unusual in people who don't have a history of sexual abuse. So we're not necessarily talking about problems that are specific to sexual abuse. Also, as you look at the data, it's important to think about what you're looking at rather than just taking off running with it. For example, there are a few studies that suggest that in clinical samples, as many as 96 to 100% of the sample meet criteria for PTSD. Gee, that makes it sound like everybody who's sexually abused has PTSD. But it's important to notice these are samples of people who sought treatment in programs that are identified as, you know, sexual abuse treatment programs. And we've got other data that shows that actually a significant portion of people who experience things that everybody agrees are sexual abuse, like rape, you know, a significant portion of people who are raped are doing okay a year later, even without any treatment whatsoever. So it's not that 100% end up with PTSD. It's that the people who've been sexually abused and have PTSD are most likely to show up at a treatment program that's identified as a sexual abuse treatment program. Now, also another question I would have in looking at this data is, are the people in these treatment programs doing the diagnoses sticking to the criteria, or are they overdiagnosing PTSD? Because it's real easy to look at somebody who's had a traumatic experience and is having problems and, without thinking, label that PTSD without paying attention to, does it meet the criteria for PTSD? Or is this person having trauma-related problems, but it's not actually PTSD, it's some other trauma-related problem? And so making sense of the data is not necessarily simple and straightforward. I'll mention on the first page of the handouts, we've got a bunch of good resources. This happens to be something where there's a lot of good material available. To get a rough estimate of the impact of sexual abuse, on page 2 in the handouts, I've got a breakdown of a meta-analysis. It's a little old now, but of the data up through, I think, 2000. What we have here are effect sizes. So, you know, the 40.5-0.6 range is a moderate to strong relationship. You know, the 0.2-0.3 range is a mild to moderate relationship. And you can see that, a history of childhood sexual abuse has an impact on a bunch of different things. But the impact varies a lot from person to person. And it doesn't have the same impact for everybody. To get a more concrete example, let's go to the videotape. What I've got here, this is a role play done in front of a live audience, and we saw a different chunk of this video when we were talking about PTSD, because the client in this case, this is the woman whose brother was murdered, and she was going over to dinner and walked in on the crime scene, and the police had her identify the body, etc. But there was also the history of her brother playing childhood sex games with her, which was, you know, complex, and she had a complex reaction to. And so here she's being interviewed about the impact that the childhood sexual experiences. That's this afternoon's handout. This morning's handout is over here. So here she's talking about the impact that her childhood experiences with her brother and her friend had on her.
Were you having reactions prior to the his being killed, to his being murdered, about that?
Like what kind? Of, like the nightmares and stuff?
Yeah, any of the symptoms we talked about.
Not really.
And I think that affected you.
Sometimes, and and I've never really been comfortable.
So it was a little unclear there, but she's saying she didn't have any specific PTSD symptoms. She's not having nightmares and flashbacks and so on. But that doesn't mean it's having no impact on her.
With people seeing it, and that's caused problems with relationships. And I've had boyfriends complain about that.
So some intimacy issues.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, one thing to notice here, the client saying, I've been self-conscious about, you know, my body being seen, you know, and this has been an issue in relationships. My boyfriends have complained about that. Reframing it as intimacy issues is inaccurate. We're not talking about intimacy issues. We're talking about being uncomfortable with my body being seen. And it's the sort of thing that's it's easy for us to translate stuff into technical terminology without doing quality control and making sure this fits.
And if I'm treating the client as though she's got intimacy issues when she's actually self-conscious about her body being seen, I'm treating the wrong problem. Yeah. Say,
so how is this, like a lot of people, kind of self-conscious about body being seen?
Right. And so that's one thing useful to notice. This is one impact that it's having for this client, but it's not something that's specific to sexual abuse. Lots of people are self-conscious about their bodies, and they haven't been sexually abused, and it has nothing to do with that. And a lot of the different impacts that sexual abuse has are problems you can develop in other ways too.
So this is this assessment stage right now? Assessing for PTSD or?
No, well actually they've already done the initial evaluation and have agreed on goals and have started treatment, and the therapist here is Patricia Resick, who does cognitive processing therapy, and she's doing a demo of cognitive processing therapy. And the first stage of cognitive processing therapy is the client giving a first-person account of whatever traumatic experience they had. But at this point, you know, she's in the process of sorting out, you know, do we need to do that with the childhood sexual experiences too, or just with the walking in on the brother's scene? So it's sort of at farther into therapy, more detailed assessment is what's going on here.
But yourself, then.
I feel kind of damaged, like people know that about me, and it's a problem, and they don't really want me the same way that they would otherwise.
I've heard it a couple different times now on different topics. You're real concerned about how other people think about you.
Yeah.
Okay. That may be something we'll have to think about. Do you make assumptions? Do you think about what people start? Is that just something you get concerned about, that people are going to think about you certain ways?
I don't think it's assumptions. Like I said, people don't talk to me, and they try to avoid it, and they're really awkward, you know, when they come up and say, you know, well, you know, sorry about your brother or something like that, but it's always really awkward, and like I said, you know, boyfriends I've had said stuff about it, so they've gotten mad that I have to keep the lights off and stuff like that. So I don't think it's an assumption, it's what is.
Okay, so
And just a quick aside on the technique front, one thing you'll notice is Patricia is not writing anything down, which makes it a whole lot harder to get stuff right. Mm-hmm. You know, what the client said was, I feel damaged, you know, people know that about me, they don't want me the way they would otherwise. And having quotes of that, you know, is really useful when we get to the intervention stage. You know, but if I hadn't written it down, I wouldn't have quotes of it either. You know, this in the heat of the moment, it's not easy to get things in the client's words if you're not writing it down. And we don't need to, you know, write all the time. We don't need to do a transcript. But when there's something that's clearly relevant, getting it down in the client's words really makes their job a lot easier.
Do you think someone might not write because, you know, certain topics are super sensitive and it's just they want to give undivided attention? And I mean, would it make mm-hmm. me nervous if I'm writing all that stuff down?
Well, that's a good question, and there's a couple different parts to it. One is, I definitely want to give my client my undivided attention at the points in the session when I need to give them my undivided attention. You know, in general, if the client bursts into tears, I'm going to stop writing and focus, you know, on the moment. And also at any point, I can pause writing, address whatever is going on in the moment, and then say, now, what was it you said a few minutes ago? And then write it down. You know, so that's one important part of it. Certainly, some topics are more sensitive than others, and there's no shortage of clients who are going to be, at first, sensitive to some extent about me writing stuff down. And that's one of the reasons it's a good idea to establish a precedent from the very beginning of writing stuff down. In the initial evaluation, I'm jotting stuff down, and we're talking about goals I'm jotting stuff down, and I'm getting mundane, ordinary, non-sensitive family history, I'm jotting stuff down. Then when we get to sensitive stuff and I'm still jotting stuff down, for the vast majority of clients, it's not an issue because they're used to it. This is just what I do. If I wait until something sensitive comes up and then whip out my clipboard and start writing stuff down, then that makes it feel like a much bigger deal. And also then I don't have the goals written down. I don't have the details of the family history written down, and I'm going to end up getting stuff wrong. Maybe your memory is better than mine, but... And so... Now, another part of it is, you know, I'm going to pay attention to nonverbal cues. I'm going to be getting feedback on a regular basis. And if the client is so uncomfortable with me writing stuff down that it gets in the way, I've got the option of not doing it, you know, in selected cases or selected situations. And, you know, for quite a few years, I had a client where I didn't write anything down. Why? Well, before she started seeing me, first she was in psychoanalysis for 10 years or so, and her analyst didn't write stuff down, even though analysts often write stuff down. And then her analyst died on her in mid-analysis, which is not an easy thing. It wasn't his idea. He had
ten
cancer.
10 years in mid-analysis?
Hmm?
10 years, he said, and she died in mid-analysis?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, traditional psychoanalysis often goes for 15, 20 years. You know, not that I would advocate that. And then she was in therapy with a cognitive behavioral therapist using a generic approach who didn't take notes. And he moved out of town. You know, so when she started seeing me and I started writing stuff down, she had a really strong reaction to it because it was a vivid reminder that I was not them. And it stirred up all her abandonment issues and so on. And the drawbacks greatly outweighed the benefits of having notes. And so, you know, I did therapy with her without taking notes because that worked better, you know, in this particular case. You know, and over the years, you know, I've had less than a half dozen clients where I don't take notes. You know, I take notes with virtually everybody, but every once in a while there's a good reason to make an exception. Now, with the people who are uncomfortable with it, you know, usually if I explain, A, why I'm doing it, you know, I find that I'm able to be more helpful when I can get things in their words, when I get the details right. You know, my memory's not good enough to, you know, just do it in my head without important things getting forgotten or distorted. You know, if I write it down, this enables me to be more helpful to them. That makes sense to clients. And also, what am I writing down? I'm just putting down in their words what they told me so I can remember it. And this is confidential. Nobody's going to see it without their permission. You know, for the vast majority of people, that takes care of it and it's not a problem. And if you think about it, imagine you were in therapy. Now, one option is you've got a therapist who nods and says aha at appropriate times and seems to be awake. And the other option is you've got a therapist who says aha at appropriate times, seems to be awake, and writes down the important stuff. Which feels more like you're being heard and taken seriously? Now, for most people, the writing stuff down is actually a plus, because they feel like we're really paying attention and taking things seriously. Also, a positive side effect is, you know, after a while, clients notice what I write down and what I don't write down, and they figure the stuff I'm writing down must be important, so they pay more attention to it too. And so they're noticing the relevant thoughts, the relevant details, without me even having to say, hey, isn't that important? Mm-hmm.
I have a question about writing things down. This is my standard procedure. When I meet the first time, I review the confidentiality policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I have a pad and I write. This So, do you explain why you're taking notes? Or because I don't go through that process.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I already did the confidentiality.
Yeah. I don't generally explain unless the person asks or if there are any obvious cues that they're wondering about it or uncomfortable. For the vast majority of clients, you know, I sit down, I start writing stuff down, and they just either presume that's what I do and take it in stride, or if they haven't been in therapy before, they presume that's what all therapists do. You know, and if you think about it, you know, if you meet with an architect, they're probably going to jot down some notes. If you meet with an accountant, they're going to probably jot down some notes. If you meet with an attorney, they're going to probably jot down some notes. You know, the average person doesn't find it terribly remarkable if I write stuff down. You know, now, if the person's been in therapy previously with a therapist who didn't take notes, they notice my approach is different than their previous therapist. But also, for most people, that's not a surprise. You know, a great many people realize that not every therapist does things in the same way. So the vast majority of the time, it's not an issue at all. It's if you've been doing therapy up to this point in your life without writing things down, it's uncomfortable for the first week or two. And like many other things in life, it takes going ahead and doing it to get comfortable with it and to get smooth at it. You know, another piece is there are times when clients say lots of stuff and I can't keep up with them. And it's completely legit to say, hold on for a minute, let me catch up with you, write down the important bits, and then say, okay, well, you know, completely legit. I want to minimize that because sometimes it disrupts the flow, but it's usually not a problem at all. How's all that sound? So anyway, I mean, she's does fine with this, but her job would be easier if she, you know, had the client's exact words, and that would help her be more on target.
Relationships.
Yeah.
Okay. But are you also concerned if they knew about the child incidents that they you seem to be implying that they would be judging you in some way?
I think so. I mean, because I didn't have to go along with it, I certainly could have said something, made them stop, or said something to my parents, and I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about that for a couple of minutes. At the time, you were not uncomfortable with it?
I was uncomfortable because, you know, they were looking at me, and I kind of felt like I was on display or something.
Mm-hmm.
But like my friends, their older brothers and sisters never played with them. And
do you know them?
Well, they complain that, like, you know, they call them tag-along.
You know, another just technique thing, you know, she says, you know, my other friends, or brothers and sisters, didn't want to have them along. And Pat, you know, Chen, do you know that? You know, it's basically looking at the evidence. This is not the time for challenging that. We're trying to get the client's story. And it works much better to get the story and then go back and challenge the bits we want to challenge. And if you're writing stuff down, you can do that. If you're not writing stuff down, you have to challenge it when it pops up, because in 5 minutes you won't remember that detail. But it throws off the timing. You know, you're challenging stuff prematurely. Or when you don't yet know if it's important, is it important to know whether her friend's older siblings wanted to have them along or not? I see no way that's at all relevant to the client's issues. But if I have to challenge stuff when it pops up, I don't have a chance to think through, is this important to focus on, or are there more important things to address?
But what about the fact that, you know, while she's talking about it, important to do the intervention right then, because she is kind of, I guess, you take notes, you remember, right?
Yeah, that's the point. And if I'm intervening before I've heard the story, I don't know what's important and what's not important yet, so it's much harder to be on target. You know, if I've heard the overall story, then I've got a clearer sense of what's important. I still may need to clarify and so on, but I've got a clearer sense of what's important and what's not important, so it's much easier to be on target.
Can I
mm-hmm.
Explain a little bit more? What? Now, this is kind of more deeper issue, like, but sometimes you have client working, there's something happen, and that's really aggravating the client.
Mm-hmm.
So you are processing that. For example, let's say client came in, just had a big fight with the partner,
mm-hmm.
and this is what today's topic is. You only have so much time.
Mm-hmm.
If you just waiting to hear the whole story, because sometimes stories goes back there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to do the intervention there because
Right, and it's a matter of finding a balance. If I just passively sit and wait for the client to say everything they've got in mind, and then I'm going to intervene, you know, with some clients the session will be done before I have a chance to get a word in edgewise.
Exactly.
This doesn't mean I want to intervene before I've heard the story. It means I want to see about getting the client to be concise and on topic, you know, and get to the point quickly. And so in a situation like that, if I just freeform, the client comes in upset about a run-in with their partner, and I just passively listen, you know, a lot of clients can fill the whole hour that way without me getting a chance to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose I say, okay, this sounds important. First of all, what was the situation? When did this happen? And they tell me. And I say, how were you feeling? And they tell me. And I say, what thoughts went through your head? And they tell me. And I say, what did you do then? And they tell me. We probably can cover that in 5 or 10 minutes. And we've got another 40 minutes or so to address it, because I've heard the story, but I've structured it in a way where we get to the important stuff reasonably quickly, the client feels heard and understood, and we don't spend a lot of the session rambling, because, you know, clients, you know, aren't necessarily... Some clients come into my office being really good at expressing themselves clearly and concisely and getting to the point. Most people don't. You know, they haven't had training about how to be a good client. They don't know what's important and what's not important. They're talking about stuff that's really upsetting, and we humans aren't at our best when we're really upset. So I want to take an active role in structuring things in the hopes of being efficient and productive, but I also want to understand what's going on and then intervene, rather than shooting from the hip before I understand what's going on.
Did your brother call you a tag along?
No, he usually was fine with my following him. That's why, like, my friend said that he was such a great brother,
mm-hmm.
because, like, if he was going out bike riding, I could go with him, and mm-hmm. like their older brothers and sisters wouldn't let them unless, like, their parents made them.
Okay. So you've got some kind of sense that you were participating in this, doing something wrong. Is that what your judgment is on this now?
Oh, now I think so. At the time, it was weird. Like, I knew I shouldn't tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they'd get mad at me. But I think of it differently.
Did you?
No more.
You did. I'm not clear about this. Or you did or didn't know at the time that there was anything wrong with this?
That's what I mean. I didn't know it was wrong, like, the way I know it's wrong now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I knew some other kid was doing this now, like, I would try and stop it, and I would say, no, that's wrong. And I would say, like, that's molestation, or that's abuse, and that's not okay, and you should tell someone, or, you know, I'd try and make it stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think of it that way then. I just knew it was a secret.
Because they told you it was a secret?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. So at the time, you were okay about it, but slightly uncomfortable? Because they were saying it's kind of a secret game you're playing. Okay, were you flattered?
And sort of. I liked that they wanted to spend so much time with me, and they trust me with their secrets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I know better, that just seems so creepy.
And tell me about that. What do you mean creepy?
It's just, I shouldn't have been flattered by it. I mean, that's just wrong.
But that's looking back now.
Right.
Okay. That's one of the things we're going to work on, is one of the basic concepts is not fair to judge now what you didn't know then.
Okay.
So at the time, if we go back in time, not looking on how you feel now about it, what you think about it now, but at the time, how did you feel about it and think about it?
Just like you said, like, mostly okay, a little bit of uncomfortable, but not like it was horrible.
Okay. At what point in time did you start saying, there's something wrong with this?
I guess when I got a little older and started learning about sex and started doing all those presentations in school and my, you know, they'd have, like, people come to school and we had health classes and some of the stuff they were describing was, like, what we had done. But if they were talking about it, like, this is a crime and, you know, all this stuff.
So you started feeling badly about yourself at that point? Okay, and you started feeling badly about your brother. What were you saying? What were you thinking at this point then?
And I was mostly really mad at him about his friend, that he let his friend do that. But I didn't really work up the courage to ask him about it for a pretty long time. And even then, it wasn't like super direct, but it was sort of asking him. And he said he didn't know. And like I said, he said he wouldn't have let him do that. But we kind of dropped it. Like, it wasn't really, it wasn't comfortable for either of us to talk about.
Did you stop being close? You said you weren't, when he died, you weren't as close as you were previously. So there's clearly some meanings attached to all that. You didn't get the relationship fixed before he died. And you said, you told me earlier on you were very close with him. He didn't call you a tag along and, you know, included you. At what point did things shift?
It's like a couple of years after that. Like, he went into high school and just wasn't around that much.
Okay, so that's just sort of a natural shifting. It wasn't because of the abuse?
I guess so. I mean, it's hard to tell because that was kind of the same time that I started thinking about it differently. And
okay.
So I don't really know if it would have been different.
So were you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, were you, at the time you started getting all these lectures and you started hearing this is a crime or this is wrong, what were the emotions you were feeling?
Mostly just like there is something wrong with me. Like, it's just kind of dirty and kind of nasty and just wrong.
Okay, so you were blaming yourself for having been in that situation then? And not
so.
Telling your parents or whatever for not knowing that that was a wrong thing at the time?
I guess. I mean, the way you say it now, it sounds really stupid. But
what do you mean?
When you're saying now that I was saying all of this stuff, but I didn't know it then, and when you say it that way, it sounds really dumb. But that is how it felt.
How what felt?
But it did feel like I should have said something and I should have known it was wrong. And
well, that's often what people do, is that afterwards they think they should have known something at the time. You know, that's a real common kind of reaction.
But it sounds so dumb when you say it that way. Like,
well, and one thing I might say at that point is, yes, we humans have lots of dumb stuff run through our heads. And we often don't notice it in the heat of the moment. And so it has an impact on our lives, you know, because we're not noticing what we're thinking and getting perspective on it. Questions, comments, reactions?
You know how she's taking the story, but she's doing a little bit intervention, kind of like things right now. Few seconds ago, then, you know, what were you thinking, but not processing it all the way.
Right.
Is that something she's going to go back later on, or as if you kind of ended it there?
Obviously, this is not where one would end.
Of course.
You know, at this point, you know, she's primarily simply finding out more about what happened. Up to this point, she had just a very vague sense that I think. You know, before this in the role play, she's found out that when the client was like 5, and for a few years after that, her brother and his friend had basically this kid version of strip poker, which ended up with the client being naked. And, you know, when the brother was around, no more than that happened. There were a few occasions where the brother's friend came over before the brother was home from school, and some touching ensued.
And so Pat knew basically that, and it was clear that the client had some complex feelings about it, but she didn't really know any more than that. So at this point, she's A, trying to figure out, do we clearly have PTSD from the brother's murder? Do we also have PTSD from the child sexual whatever or not? And it turns out no PTSD from this. But she's also trying to understand what impact this has had in the client's life. Because in real life, we need to say, okay, the client clearly needs treatment for the PTSD. Does she also need treatment for the history of sexual? The client doesn't label this sexual abuse. And also, from what I know about what happened, I wouldn't particularly characterize it as sexual abuse either. It's more relatively ordinary childhood sex play, but that the client feels guilty and ashamed about and has, caused an assortment of problems for the client. And it highlights some of the complexity of figuring out what counts as abuse and what doesn't. And just because something's not abuse doesn't mean it's not a problem. And one of the complexities of doing live demos in front of an audience is, whoever's doing the demo probably doesn't do this on a regular basis and is probably a little anxious and self-conscious themselves. And also, it's a complex activity. If I'm in my office doing therapy with a client, I'm just focusing on the client. If I'm doing a live demo in front of an audience, I'm focusing on the client and thinking about the various points I want to illustrate and trying to illustrate them clearly. And it's also easy to get ahead of myself because and I want to demonstrate this too. And rather than doing it when I normally would in a session, I'll do it right now, even though now isn't the time I would actually do it with a client. So, doing live demos is a complex activity. And some people do it really well. Pat does it okay, but, there's some things that she would do differently, with the client, I'm pretty sure, with a real client, but, that's life. If I had a better video, I would use a better video. This works well for our purposes. Some of the things that we see demonstrated on the video are real common. There's a lot of guilt and shame and self-disgust. And this comes up a lot, particularly with child sexual abuse. We heard the client saying, I didn't have to go along with it. I could have said something with the implication, therefore, everything that happened is my fault. It felt good to be included. It felt good to get attention. Oh, my God, I shouldn't be flattered by it. That's just wrong. These are real common and can have a big impact. Because if I feel like I'm a dirty, nasty, person, and if people only knew, they wouldn't like me and wouldn't want to be with me, what happens? Well, if I feel like certain aspects of me or certain aspects of my experience are not acceptable, then I'll do my best to keep them secret. And then if people like me, but they don't know these secrets about me, it feels like they don't actually like me because they don't know this stuff. And it feels like if they knew, they wouldn't like me anymore. And so it feels like the relations are fake. It's hard to let myself be intimate because then I might accidentally spill the beans and let people know things about myself. And it really complicates relationships. And also, if I succeed in keeping this stuff secret, I never discovered how people really would react to it, really do react to it. And a lot of people go through their lives keeping stuff secret that actually isn't that big a deal and that people aren't going to have that big a reaction to. Or keeping secret stuff that is a big deal to some extent, but if people knew about it, they would be initially shocked, and then they would think it over, and then they would come to terms with it, and then they would accept the person. You know, for example, I've got a client currently who has a history of a big-time eating disorder, which she's been very ashamed of, and hardly any of the people in her life currently know about it because she thinks this is a horrible thing that, you know, people would no longer like her, people would no longer respect her, etc. In reality, if I have a history of a big-time eating disorder and I tell you, gee, when I was a teenager, I had a terrible eating disorder, are you going to run away screaming? Now, are non-mental health professionals going to run away screaming? No, the vast majority of people are going to say, gee, that's a shame, I'm glad you're doing better, and it's not going to be a problem. But as long as I keep it a secret, it feels like something that I need to keep a secret because I don't discover that, oh, people aren't as shocked and horrified of this as I expect. And so, you know, people often have major feelings of isolation. Nobody really knows me. I can't get close to people and so on. And this client does in a little less intensely than that, but she feels pretty isolated, both with the sexual issues and with her brother's murder. You know, she has this gut feeling that nobody can understand. Now, my bet is if she talked to people about it, she would discover, no, actually, people can understand just fine. They think, oh, how would I feel if my brother got murdered? Oh, my God, that would be terrible. But since she's not comfortable talking about it with people, you know, she doesn't discover that. And it wouldn't be at all surprising if her history of being uncomfortable talking about sexual experiences set her up to also not be comfortable talking about other things. She just got in the habit of keeping quiet about stuff where she's not sure how people would react to it. So my bet is that over the course of therapy, it'll turn out that there are lots of things that she keeps to herself rather than talking about that are unnecessary, that aren't that big a deal. And that if she was more willing to talk about her thoughts and feelings, she'd feel a lot closer to the people around her and feel a lot less isolated. A lot of sexual abuse experiences involve some degree of a betrayal of trust, particularly if the perpetrator is a family member or a friend or somebody you've got a professional relationship with. And if I've been betrayed in one relationship, that can make it harder to trust other people. You know, it's a whole lot easier to go around trusting people if nobody's ever betrayed you. The more experiences of where a violation of trust you've had, the harder it is to, you know, let yourself trust a new person. And that has big ramifications in relationships. Another important aspect, particularly for child sexual abuse, is often the kid gets the message that, you know, it's either not okay to say no, you know, because the, you know, perpetrator is telling them they can't say no. The perpetrator is telling them there will be terrible repercussions if they don't go along with it. The perpetrator is telling them there will be terrible repercussions if they let anybody else know about it. And a lot of people walk away from it with the sense that it's not okay to say no, it's not okay to set limits, it's not okay to speak up for myself. Which then has repercussions in relationships above and beyond the sexual level. And, you know, sets, you know, certainly can increase the risk of subsequent victimization. And you can also get into complex things. If I'm sexually abused as a kid, and among other things, I'm getting lots of attention. Here she's getting attention from her brother. And if up to that point in my life I haven't been getting as much attention as I wanted, and here I'm getting unwelcome attention, but it's attention, then it's complex. And A, is it okay to like getting attention even if I'm getting it in a bad way? B, okay, in the future when I want attention, how do I get attention? And if in the kid's mind, hey, sex is the way I get attention, you know, then, you know, one way it can play out is, you know, sort of precocious sexuality, using sex as a way to get attention. You know, or you can have, you know, aversion to sexuality and the delayed sexual development. It can go either way. So there's all sorts of complexities. And one thing is, you know, with most everything up to this point in the course, you know, the next thing in the handouts would be a handy-dandy cognitive model of whatever it is we're talking about. I don't have one of those for sexual abuse. Because my sense is there's so much variation from person to person, both in terms of there's incredible variation in what actually happened, at what age, who was the perpetrator, how was it handled, etc. But also, each person reacts in their own way. There's so much individual variation that I haven't been able to come up with a decent generic model of how the average person reacts. This is something where I think you really need to take an individualized approach because there's so much variation. And this also, you know, fits with the research. You know, there's been a lot of research done trying to come up with good ways to predict how things are going to turn out. You know, and for example, you know, many sexual assault victims regain their psychological equilibrium without professional intervention within 6 months or so. You know, others have ongoing problems and need professional intervention. You know, others have ongoing problems despite professional intervention. You know, and it would be great if we could predict who's going to turn out fine and who's going to need help. The research hasn't come up with a good way of predicting that. I mean, there's the general, if what happens is really mild, it's probably not going to have a big impact. And if what happens is really terrible, it's probably going to have a big impact. But other than that simple, obvious thing, the research hasn't come up with a whole lot that's useful. A lot of attempts have been tried to look at, you know, the characteristics of the abuse. You know, who's the perpetrator? You know, exactly what behaviors happened, etc. You know, whether it's incest or not, whether force was used or not, etc. And the results are not at all impressive. None of this does a very good job of predicting who's going to be screwed up and who's going to do okay. You know, we need more research, but my bet is that it's going to turn out that the answer lies in a lot of individual stuff. You know, both what was the situation before the abuse happened, and what was the chain of events afterwards. And so we're going to get a lot of variations. If you look at the bottom of page 2, we've got one example. This is a former client of mine, Maria, who I was seeing her when she was in her mid-30s. And on the history front, for those who aren't used to seeing genograms, the circles are females, the squares are males. Everybody who's on the same line horizontally is in the same generation. So up at the top, we have Maria's mom and dad, and then dropping down is Maria and her sister. And so Maria's mom was a saint, according to the parish priest. She spent much of her time helping others, and this was, you know, very appreciated in the community, and everybody thought it was wonderful. But it meant that Mama was actually not that available to Maria and her sister. And also, Maria was sort of getting indirectly the message that this is the way she's supposed to be. Maria's dad was an Italian immigrant who happened to have an explosive temper. He wasn't a bad guy, but he had a very short fuse. And he saw himself and his family as peasants from the background he came from. When Maria was in early adolescence, some of her friends were taking horseback riding lessons. So one evening she said, "Dad, can I take horseback riding lessons too?" And Dad's reaction was, "Oh my God, no, we're peasants." Because back in the old country, if a peasant was caught on horseback, they were in big trouble. The nobility rode horses. The peasants shuffled up after the horses, and if you got out of your place, you were going to be in big trouble. You know, now this was a relatively medieval portion of Italy,
that her dad grew up in. You know, that culture stuck with him pretty vigorously. Maria was the oldest of two kids, and her job from 5 or 6 on was to take care of her little sister. And so she was given a lot of responsibility at an age where she was not developmentally ready for it yet. And it was her job to make sure nothing happened to her sister. You know, it was her job to make sure everything was okay. You know, at some point in her childhood, she was sexually abused by a neighbor. Her sister, and she had a good relationship with her sister. They got along well. And then when her sister was in 8 to 10, I think, sister developed a brain tumor. Went into a local medical institution with a great reputation, and the surgeon botched the surgery, left in a sponge. There was a post-op infection, and the little sister ended up blind and paraplegic. And wait a minute, it's Maria's job to make sure nothing bad happens to her sister. Yeah, so we've got a variety of things going on in the family that have nothing to do with sexual abuse, but that complicate Maria's reaction to the initial sexual abuse. I'm pretty sure the time sequence was that she was feeling guilty and blaming herself for her sister's medical problems, and then she was sexually abused by the neighbor. And so she went into this already, you know, blaming herself, feeling responsible, feeling like she's not okay, feeling like she's not living up to being a saint the way her mom is. And then she gets sexually abused, and this is an added layer of complexity. And then a few years later, she got molested by her dentist. And then as an adult, she got raped by a stranger. And so also, we've got a series of, and she had some unfortunate but fairly ordinary bad experiences in relationships. And so lots of different things going on, lots of moving parts here. How's all this sound so far? Yeah, and one thing that makes a big difference in the impact of the abuse is, what conclusions do I draw? What does it say about me that this happened? You know, what does it say about others? What does it say about the world? What does this tell me about how other people are going to react to me, etc.? Another example where I've got a clear picture of the some of the beliefs that the client acquired. On the top of page 3, let's call this person Michelle. Oh, Claire, this is the pseudonym I'm using. Claire grew up in a family where mom was a homemaker and a chronic worrier. Claire was the oldest of the kids, and mom got in the habit of confiding in Claire about her worries and concerns from a pretty early age. And, you know, also, mom, by virtue of her own history, really objected vigorously to people expressing feelings. And, you know, whenever anybody got upset, she told them in no uncertain terms not to let it show. And that actually they shouldn't feel that way. Concrete example, dad's mom died. On the way home from the funeral, he had some tears, and mom yelled at him about showing sadness that his mother had died. Dad was a factory worker in an industry that had frequent layoffs as the economy went up and down. And when he was working, he often worked lots of overtime and made good money. But it wouldn't be long at all till the industry crashed and he was laid off for 6 months or whatever. He was an adult child of an alcoholic. You know, he had a short fuse, yelled at everybody a lot, and was not at all warm or affectionate, because he'd grown up in a family that was not at all warm and affectionate.
From age 5, Claire was expected to watch her younger siblings and to be responsible, by which her family meant she was supposed to, on her own, know what was okay and what was not okay and manage to not do anything bad and not break any rules and not upset anybody, which is a pretty tall order when you're 5, 6, 7. She was sexually abused by her alcoholic grandfather from the ages of roughly 5 to 12, whenever they visited Grandpa. And the impact this had on her, we've got her dysfunctional beliefs the next layer down, between, you know, her upbringing and the sexual abuse, she concluded, you know, I must not upset my parents ever. You know, if my parents are upset, I must have done something wrong. It must be my fault. I have to do everything perfectly to make sure my parents never get upset. If my parents are upset, I have to make it okay. Including as, say, like a second grader, Mom would be really worried about their finances because Dad was laid off. And Claire would put a lot of time and energy trying to come up with plans for how to handle the finances so that they would be able to pay the mortgage and so on. Wait a minute, this is not something a 7-year-old can figure out. It's not something a 7-year-old's responsible for. But she felt responsible for it. And in her family, she was told what to do and was supposed to do it perfectly without needing reminders, without needing coaching. And she was taught in no uncertain terms, it's not okay to ever say no to anything. It's not okay to set limits. You know, you're supposed to fulfill your responsibilities. You're not supposed to do what you want. You're not supposed to look out for your own needs. She also went to parochial schools and got a lot of these messages from the nuns, too, back in the old days when the nuns enforced this stuff pretty vigorously with the ruler across the knuckles. And so, coming into all this, she gets sexually abused by Grandpa, and, you know, she has this kid-level sense that this is wrong. But wait a minute, I was a participant. So rather than seeing herself as a victim of sexual abuse, she saw herself as somebody who had done something wrong. And it seemed to her, there's no way to make up for it. You know, I'm now dangerous, I'm flawed, I'm not okay, and I'll never be okay. And she also, you know, had this gut sense that if somebody I care about expects something of me, I have to try as hard as possible to do it. It's not okay to say no. It's not okay to look out for my own interests. It's not okay to negotiate a reasonable compromise or anything. Also, by virtue of the economic ups and downs her family experienced, she walked away from her childhood with a sense that if you've got money, you better spend it today because it won't be around tomorrow. That's a quote from her, which had a big impact on how she handled her personal finances. And as you look at this, you know, some of these are related to the sexual abuse. Some of these are related to other aspects of her upbringing and predated the sexual abuse. And these had an impact on how she dealt with the sexual abuse, too. Not only did Grandpa threaten her and tell her she'd better not tell anybody about it or she'd be in big trouble, but she also had, before the sexual abuse, developed this strong sense that, you know, she should avoid upsetting her parents at all costs. And if I tell my parents Grandpa's abusing me, you know, that risks people being upset. So she had a strong sense that she didn't dare tell anybody. There's certainly no guarantee that her parents would have handled it well anyway. But actually, my sense is they might have handled it perfectly fine had she told them. But since it was something potentially upsetting, she had this really strong sense that she didn't dare tell them. You know, and she's now not quite 50. And this stuff still sticks with her real strongly. She currently lives with her parents.
and she and her dad share a car. And if, you know, she is planning on using the car and he says, oh, I need it, she is really not capable of saying, gee, Dad, I've got plans. Do you need it this morning or could you run your errands this afternoon? You know, she really has a hell of a time doing something as mild as that for fear of upsetting him. Even though all he does is yell, and he's now a little old guy who's no threat to anybody.
Why does she live with her parents?
She is currently on disability for a variety of mental health issues. And actually, we've now gotten up to the point where I'm pretty sure she could work full-time when she finds an appropriate job. She's a little less confident about that than I am. But one of the challenges in our current system is she's on disability, which among other things means she gets Medicaid, so she's got health insurance coverage. And one of her concerns and her family's concerns is, suppose she finds a job and takes it and then can't handle it. Oh my God, she's lost her disability. Oh my God, she's lost her insurance coverage. So do I dare try working in order to find out where I can handle it or not? Gee, seems like I'd better not risk it unless I'm certain I can handle a full-time job. But how can I be certain I can handle a full-time job if I haven't worked full-time in the last 20 years? You know, and if I rule the world, I design things a little differently so it's easier to make a transition off of disability. You know, I've actually had, over the years, have had a fair number of clients on disability who I was convinced, you know, could have gradually worked their way off disability if the system was set up to facilitate that. But often the system is set up in ways that make that harder rather than easier.
So, is Claire, does she have no job right now?
She has, right at the very moment, she has no job and is job hunting. Her most recent job was a time-limited grant-funded job for a year, and it ended at the end of the year. And she procrastinated about finding a new job, and so is now in a gap in between. She's had a number of part-time jobs that she did well at, as well as a number of part-time jobs where her issues muffed things up. But you know, that's all stuff we've burned. She had a job as a file clerk, and she was so perfectionistic that she was too slow. And we've worked on her perfectionism. You know, her most recent job, you know, could have been extended for a second year, but it wasn't because she had a problem with showing up on time, which is she was doing some avoiding because she was afraid of criticism. You know, and that's another thing that we've worked on, and I don't think that'll be a problem in her next job, but we'll see when she gets her next job.
Was she dating?
Yeah, another interesting piece of her history. Back 20-ish years ago, she finished college, finished her master's, had a full-time job in her field, and was dating a guy, and he sounded quite reasonable, and things were going well. And then two different things happened at roughly the same time. One was he invited her over for dinner, and it occurred to him, oh, maybe he has more in mind than just dinner. Maybe he's thinking of a sexual relationship. This freaked her out. And so she broke off contact, stopped returning her phone calls, etc., because it was such a scary idea, and this was clearly related to her history of sexual abuse. And if that was all that was happened, you know, my bet is she would have taken a little time, thought it over, calmed down, gotten back in touch with him, you know, and it might well have worked out. But another one of her issues with the, you know, don't upset anybody, don't show feelings, is she got into a chronic pattern of suppressing emotions, particularly suppressing anger. And she had an annoying boss. And her boss did a variety of different things that aggravated her, and she smiled and held it in, and didn't acknowledge being angry, and didn't show any anger, and didn't address any of the issues, and gradually got more and more fed up to the point where she couldn't hold it in anymore. And so she threw a major hissy fit over some small thing he said or did, while she happened to be holding a spork in her hand.
Spork?
Yes, I'm not making this up. And she happened to have a boss who had his own issues with anger, and he freaked out and charged her with assault.
Oh, my God.
She was just yelling and holding a spork, and she was holding the spork by coincidence, not because she intended to use it as a weapon. And she's also under 5'2". And not at all athletic. She was no threat to anybody. But he pressed charges because of his own issues. And she ended up getting hospitalized in a psych unit. And her husband, her family drove down, brought her home, paid for an attorney, got things settled. But she instantly lost contact with all her friends in Cincinnati, lost contact with this guy. And this was before the days of Facebook and so on. So if you didn't know somebody's phone number, you know, you poof, you know. And somehow she, in all that was going on, she lost track of his phone. I think she lost her appointment book, which had all her phone numbers in it. So she didn't know how to get in touch with people because she didn't have their phone numbers memorized. And also there was a period, she was depressed, she was anxious, everything was in crisis. So it took a while for things to settle down to the point where she would contemplate getting back in touch with friends. And by that time, she, you know, A, had, you know, didn't have people's phone numbers, and B, I think she was anxious and ambivalent enough that she didn't just call up directory assistance and ask for their numbers. And so she lost touch with this guy, lost touch with all her friends in Cincinnati, you know, and spent, you know, the next 5-10 years home in her bedroom being depressed. You know, then she got some treatment, and by the time she started seeing me, she was doing a bit better, but she was still in a major depression and unemployed and so on. And I've been seeing her for quite a while now, and she's no longer depressed, and she's, you know, dealing with stuff much better, and she's, you know, starting to try new activities and, you know, et cetera. You know, she's gradually worked her way in terms of employment and so on. She's actually on a couple of boards of local community organizations and so on. But there's still plenty for us to work on. And, you know, I think part of my take-home message is here is, you know, sexual abuse doesn't happen in isolation. You know, if the person's been living a life up to this point, you know, life keeps happening afterwards. And the impacts of sexual abuse have ramifications in lots of areas of life. What was going on in my life has a big impact on how I respond to sexual abuse. So rather than being a standard model that fits everybody, it's a matter of figuring out what role does it play in this person's life and what can we do about it. Now, there are certain domains that are likely to be important and have broad impacts. And on the bottom of page 3, we've got these, you know, what conclusions I draw regarding what does this experience say to me about my safety. You know, with the woman on the videotape, one thing she says earlier in the tape, you know, by virtue of her brother being killed is, oh, my God, nobody's safe. This sort of thing can happen to anybody, anytime. And that sense of vulnerability has a bunch of ramifications. Now, why does she feel that way? Part of it is her brother was killed. Part of it is her brother happened to be killed at the same time as the Washington, D.C. sniper was shooting people out of the blue in parking lots. You know, it turned out he was had hidden in the trunk of a car with a little peephole he could shoot through. But that had not been figured out yet. Just people were being shot in parking lots for no obvious reason with no obvious perpetrator. And that certainly really reinforced her sense of vulnerability. What does this experience tell me about trusting other people? What does this tell me about my power in the world? Particularly for kids who are people who were sexually abused as kids,
But also, being sexually abused as an adult, often there's a lot of experience of helplessness and powerlessness. And people often generalize it into a general sense of themselves as being helpless and powerless in the world. What does this tell me about my worth? You know, and often people, particularly with sexual childhood abuse, but also with adult abuse, walk away from it with a sense that they're now flawed. They're no longer okay. They're different from other people. You know, if people knew, they wouldn't like me. If people knew, they wouldn't want me, etc. What does this tell me about intimacy in relationships? Particularly if I've been abused by somebody I had an intimate relationship with, this may well convince me that intimacy is dangerous and may well have me avoiding intimacy in other relationships. And what does this tell me about assertion, communication, setting limits, saying no? Often people walk away with either the sense that it's not okay to speak up for myself, to set limits, to say no, or the sense that it's not going to work, it's not going to do any good. At this point, let's take a 10-minute break.